Hello, you're listening to The Wire. My name is Stephen Regal, coming to you from 4EB in Brisbane today. Today, the government passes its education funding scheme after the Senate pulls an all-nighter.
To an extent, I think we're going to have a better deal and a clearer deal that is certainly more consistent in terms of the way that different schools are treated across the different states, territories and sectors.
And is the housing market overheated? Well, we are just not looking hard enough for a bargain.
I don't believe that there's an affordability issue across the nation. I believe that no doubt property is expensive, but there are still very affordable pockets that people can get into.
And the Queensland government withdraws future funding for the Safe Schools program.
We are losing lives across the school system and it's not okay. So be it the Safe Schools or whatever it is, there needs to be some type of support in education with teachers, with social workers, with nurses, with doctors.
All of that and more independent current affairs coming up over the next half hour. Thanks for tuning in. In what is being billed as a victory for the coalition government, the Senate passed its reworked education funding scheme in the early hours of this morning. Gonski 2.0 will increase funding to government and non-government schools around the country, while some will have theirs reduced, a turnaround from the former Labor government's no school will be worse off promise. Still, it's a lot less money than Labor promised, $23.5 billion until 2023, instead of the $37.3 billion promised by Labor until 2026. The Greens were able to get several amendments made to the package, including $5 billion on top of the original $18 billion promised, and a shorter funding timeline. But pressure from education unions forced them to drop their support, with the party on the verge of splitting on the vote. President of the Australian Education Union, Karina Haythorpe, says the new agreement shortchanges schools who were expecting more funding under previous arrangements.
The government may well hail this as a victory, but it's not a victory for our students, because as a result of this bill, we now see five state and territory signed funding agreements in New South Wales, South Australia, Tasmania, the ACT and Victoria torn up, and billions of dollars of vital funding that was meant to flow to our schools in the next 2 years will now not be delivered. These schools will now have to wait 6 years before they get anywhere near the minimum schooling resource standard that was recommended by the Gonski Review, and we don't think that that's good enough.
It's been over 5 years since the idea of a school's resourcing standard allocating funding by need was introduced by the Review of School Funding, chaired by businessman David Gonski. The Labor Party had promised $9.8 billion over 6 years to implement a version of the standard, with the promise that no school would be worse off. It also promised to fund 65% of the increases in school funding. This has been changed by the coalition government to 20% share in government schools and an 80% share in non-government schools by 2023. Karina Haythorpe says schools have had to push their plans back as a result of the new deal.
Well, quite frankly, there was a legally signed agreement between the states and the federal governments that was meant to deliver this funding for years 5 and 6, which is 2018 and 2019. So we believe that those agreements should have been honoured. Now, schools were making plans about what they were going to do with those dollars. They knew the amount of resources that were going to come to their schools. They've made plans about the learning programs that they were going to put in place, and to now be in a position where their funding will be pushed out for another 6 years or more, I think places incredible pressure on our school communities, and that's why we have taken a very strong campaigning focus to this issue.
Others will have funding removed from them as well. The Catholic sector is expected to lose around $3 billion over 10 years, while other private schools should lose money under the arrangement as well. Dr. Glenn Savage from Monash University says what the government is implementing is more like the original plan than the arrangements negotiated by the Labor Party when it was last in office.
The revised model that the coalition has just passed through the Senate is essentially the same as the original Gonski, but it's removing the various deals that were done with the states and territories and sectors. And they're also setting up a National Schools Resourcing Board, which is essentially a separate body or organisation to govern the funding of schools, which is a really good idea because it removes some of the politics and the election cycle pressures to an extent from the school funding landscape.
But the Australian Education Union sees the situation differently.
What we will see is some of the richest private schools in the nation will get funding increases up to four times greater than public schools that educate our most disadvantaged students. So I think there's a lot of political spin around this. And as we work through these amendments, the impact of them in the future, it will become very clear that we will see still great inequities in terms of over two-thirds of private schools will be above the schooling resource standard, while the vast majority of public schools will remain below.
Dr. Savage says the deal is better than the mix negotiated by the Labor Party.
To an extent, I think we're going to have a better deal and a clearer deal that is certainly more consistent in terms of the ways that different schools are treated across the different states, territories and sectors.
In future, though, he thinks the school resourcing standard benchmark should be reviewed because it is based, in part, on the socioeconomic status of the area.
A lot of kids go to private schools, but they don't live in the area that the private school's in. So if you base the payment on the local area of the school, that doesn't necessarily reflect the socioeconomic background of the student to go to the school. So the Grattan Institute and a range of other people have suggested that some reform of that aspect of the model would really help make it even more needs-based than it is at the moment.
He also questions why the government has chosen an 80-20 figure for non-government and government school funding levels.
The government may well hail this as a victory, but it's not a victory.
I understand to an extent why they are doing that, because they want to get a clear a consistent figure that they can then take to the states and work with. But at this point, there's no clear justification that has been given by the federal government as to why 80% or why 20%. So I think there needs to be some more evidence behind why the government's choosing to split it in that particular way.
And that's Glenn Savage from Monash University ending that story. Another education story, the Queensland government will stop funding to the anti-bullying program Safe Schools, which helps to educate students about gender diversity. Queensland's funding for the program will only last till the end of October, leaving local schools to use funds from their own budget if they wish to continue or replace the program. Senita Osborne reports.
Safe Schools is a program designed to educate students, staff and families about sexual and gender diversity. The anti-bullying program in Australian schools has been met with controversy from federal coalition MPs and members of the community. General Manager for Open Doors Youth Service, Pam Barker, says that Safe Schools is an important program that enables students and teachers to learn together and speak the same language when it comes to diverse sexuality, body or gender.
Safe Schools is really important for teachers and students because it gives teachers the framework and understanding about social normativity, their own biases, and how to overcome and process those and gain a better understanding of people who are different to them. And on a student level, it then means that the students who are different have teachers that are talking languages that are affirmative, that understand where they're coming from, understanding the differences between heteronormativity and a diverse sexuality, body or gender. But it also then means that the young people who don't identify with a diverse body, sexuality or gender, so the LGBTIQ community, can then get an education around why are we different? You know, what does it mean if someone's transgender? What does it mean if someone is bisexual, asexual?
Vice President for the Queensland Teachers Union, Sam Pidgeon, says despite the controversy surrounding Safe Schools, the program has made a real difference for staff and students.
There has been controversy around the program, and there's certainly been a situation where, unfortunately, some members of the community have attempted to, lobby or bully school leaders into stopping the program where they had signed up to it. That's highly unfortunate. But you know what? For all of the controversy, the main feedback that we've had is that the program has been working, it has been welcomed, and that it has actually made a real difference to not just LGBTI kids in schools, but also to our LGBTI staff and members of the school community.
Ms. Barker says programs like Safe Schools are saving lives among LGBTQI students.
These young people are put at a very high risk of depression, anxiety, and we know statistically that the stats amongst LGBTIQ community are very high when it comes to suicidality and self-harming. And I guess to decrease that is really important, and that's where programs like this come in.
Ms. Pigeon says without government funding for the program, schools will have to use funds from their own budgets, which means some might not have the capacity to run it.
Schools are given a budget from the government, and schools determine how they use that money, and they might determine to use that for particular professional development programs. But it's the view of the teachers' union that this professional development for staff is of such an essential nature. It is so important that we believe that it should be centrally funded, and we think it should be centrally organised through the Department of Education. One of the reasons for that is that we think everyone should have access to it. And if it's a school-by-school decision where schools are having to decide whether or not they've got the capacity to prioritise the funds for it, then we may actually find that schools that really need access to this training aren't accessing it for reasons of budget.
Both think the program should be replaced if it's abolished. Ms. Barker says appropriate university training should be provided for teachers.
I think it's just about understanding that, you know, we need something. So if Safe Schools is going to be not a program that's continued or paid for, then what is going to be put in its place to mitigate what's happening on the ground? And we are losing lives across the school system, and it's not okay. So be it the Safe Schools or whatever it is, there needs to be some type of support and education with teachers, with social workers, with nurses, with doctors at a university level. There should be training or a whole semester on, you know, several semesters on minorities and minority groups or specialist groups at university where they deeply touch on the needs of those groups, as well as, you know, training on the ground. And if we're not providing that at a government level, whose responsibility is it? So that's going to be a very interesting thing to consider. If Safe Schools is taken away, how are we going to negate the issue?
Ms. Pigeon says it is now the responsibility of education departments to continue the professional training begun under Safe Schools.
The Queensland Teachers Union view is that whether it's the Safe Schools program or something else, the Department of Education really needs to step up and make sure that there is something available in this really much needed space. It's very, very important that systems and departments of education across Australia make sure that we don't lose the momentum that was begun by the excellent professional development offered through the Safe Schools program. If the program's going to cease, then it is essential that states and systems pick something up and put something in place to make sure that it continues.
And that story by Sunita Osborne.
No matter where I am in the world, I check in on The Wire and find out what's making news in Australia.
The Wire, current affairs on air and online, wherever you are.
And wherever you are, you can listen back to anything you heard on today's program by going to thewire.org.au. And if you want to stay up to date with what we're doing, just join our mailing list. Those details are on our website. And there you can find out what's coming up on the show each weekday afternoon. Well, new research argues first home buyers have to give up the dream of a perfect home and get into the market. It comes as a survey found that 13% of first home buyers prefer to invest in a property and rent in a desired area. Could this be an option to address the national housing affordability problem? Eduardo Jordan has more.
The problem of rising housing prices is leading some home buyers to think outside the box. Founder and director from rentvesting.com.au, Peter Mastroianni, says getting an investment property could be a way of breaking into the market.
Simply, rent vesting is really about buying an investment rather than living in the property yourself. So you would buy an investment property first, perhaps in a more affordable location, whilst continuing to rent in your preferred location. And using a strategy such as this can bring a lot of benefits for you, as long, I guess, as it suits your inclinations and your budget and your lifestyle requirements.
Mr. Mastroianni says investing in a property or rent vesting has its benefits.
One, I guess we probably need to touch on affordability. And as you know, it's an incredibly complex area. And the market is continually changing. So home ownership is something that is very aspirational for us as Australians, and it's something that we're indoctrinated to believe that it's what we need to do to become successful in life and have security and also comfort as well. However, with house prices continuing to increase, people are just looking at different strategies or perhaps rethinking the traditional home ownership model in order to leverage themselves and get a foothold into the property ladder. And rent vesting is one way in which you can do so, because essentially what you're doing is you're letting the investment strategy do the heavy lifting.
While he acknowledges the market is expensive, he believes it's still affordable to buy a property.
So I believe that the Australian property market is made up of many different markets. I don't believe that there's an affordability issue across the nation. I believe that no doubt property is expensive, but there are still very affordable pockets that people can get into, particularly if you are a first-time buyer. Those areas may not be suitable for your lifestyle circumstances. Then, you know, rent vesting is a strategy that you can look at to maintain those lifestyle benefits and invest in other areas. But the median house price in Sydney is now over $1 million. In Melbourne, it's around about $870,000. In Brisbane, it's $550,000. And across the board, you can still buy property in terms of a detached existing home for under $600,000.
Director of Care and Todd White, Gavin Holcomb, thinks there is an issue with affordability, but it's uneven across Australia.
I think there is, but I think it's not necessarily evenly spread across the country. I think we're certainly seeing a lot more housing stress in the likes of Sydney and Melbourne, but at the same time, there's some areas of regional Australia that certainly haven't got that same level of housing affordability pressures.
Mr. Holcomb says investing outside the inner suburbs and renting where homeowners want to live could be a viable option.
I think it's certainly a viable option in that people are able to actually rent where they want to live and then buy a property where they can afford to buy. And again, I think it's probably just that step on the property ladder of actually being able to at least get into the market. It might not be exactly where you want to be, but at least it means that you're in the market, I guess, which means that you've got some exposure to the property market, particularly, you know, if it continues to increase.
It's also important to see how the house market behaves to properly rent vest.
But I guess the one thing that they've got to weigh up is where we are in the property cycle. And I think if you look across the Australian property market, we are at all different stages of that property cycle. So if you're buying at the peak of a cycle, the risk of some correction in those values is much higher. But equally, other areas of Australia are probably at the bottom end of the cycle, which means it potentially makes a lot more sense. And I guess, you know, for people that take a more of a macro view rather than sort of having to rent and buy in the same city, it means that they can potentially rent where, you know, they believe a property is towards the top of the cycle and potentially buy a property where they believe the market's towards the bottom of the cycle.
Mr. Mastroianni says it's desirable to be informed as risks happen when investing in a property.
It's always mindful that in any investment, there's going to be risks associated with this process. So first and foremost, would encourage listeners to seek professional advice wherever possible from your accountant and from your solicitor. You want to ensure that from a tax mitigation perspective that your ducks are aligned in that process, and it's always worthwhile seeking advice from a licensed mortgage broker as well in order to get the finance arrangement in place, particularly at the moment where investment lending credit policies are becoming particularly tight. So it'd be good to get some navigation through that process as well.
That story by Eduardo Jordan. A new Senate inquiry is looking into ways of restoring an acceptable level of public interest journalism across Australia and will report at the end of the year. Major media organisations have struggled in recent years to stay relevant in a new landscape dominated by digital news and social media. Cost-cutting and job losses have also caused a collapse in news topics, catering for the common good of people in all community groups. Former ABC journalist Andrew Dodd is one experienced onlooker who hopes the inquiry will deliver new government funding to support and encourage a resurgence in public interest journalism and provide a better means for meeting consumer needs in this field. He spoke with Colin Moynihan.
Andrew, Rob, welcome to the program. Can you tell me what are the areas of journalism that serve a public need that are currently underfunded and in decline.
We now know that the market is failing us. It's letting us down because there is not proper coverage of lots of institutions, particularly on a state and regional level. Local councils, local courts, even local parliaments are missing out on coverage. The arts aren't covered as well as they could be or should be. And there are lots of areas in regional and rural Australia that just simply miss out on reportage. So we're saying the time's come to augment, if you like, the market, to step in and provide a mechanism by which we can create more public interest journalism. And we've been exploring ways in which that could happen.
So in what ways is the established print media in Australia not doing its job adequately in giving prominence to the news topics that you just mentioned?
All sorts of ways Australia falls short of proper pluralist diverse coverage. We have one of the most concentrated print media regimes in the world. We have really just two media players who own the vast majority of our newspapers in circulation. There are almost no independents left. We know that those papers are now thinner than they once were, meaning they're covering much less. And we also know there have been something like 3,000 journalists laid off since 2012 across the media landscape. On top of that, there have been lots of closures and amalgamations of small country and regional newspapers. So there is a very real reporting deficit, and that's what we're trying to address.
Andrew Robb supports the establishment of an independent production fund that can offer grants to suitable applicants promoting public interest journalism. He explains how such a body might work.
Well, yeah, there is a lot of discussion about how you fix this reporting deficit. And one way that's worth exploring and looking at closer is the idea that you create an independent production fund where people step forward to this organisation and put an application in for funding around a specific project. So if they've got a public interest reporting project in mind, whether they're from community, public or commercial media, they can apply to the fund for support so that they can get that project up and off the ground. And this would be sort of analogous to something like the Arts Council handing out a grant or something like Screen Australia providing funding for a film project. But what we're asking the government to consider is whether journalism itself can be something that is subject to grants to make good things happen.
As part of its terms of reference, the Senate inquiry will be examining the effect of digital disruption to authentic news reporting through the practices mainly of the social media. Andrew Robb offers an interventionist solution that might address this problem.
Well, the rationale for this is that we know that the advertising that used to be in newspapers is now online, which means that it's gone to Google and Facebook. They're taking the lion's share of advertising.
Okay.
But they don't have any responsibility that comes with that to provide a news service, like our newspapers did and like our broadcasters have done. So if they're not providing a product in return that fills this gap in public interest journalism, then perhaps it's appropriate to tax them properly, and from those tax revenues create this fund that allows journalism to happen online and everywhere else.
Finally, if taxpayers' money is to be used to fund new creative forms of public interest journalism, do we have enough safeguards to ensure the integrity and independence of these news outlets?
Well, we currently do fund journalism through our public broadcasters, and those broadcasters have a charter where they are independent and where they operate as independent entities. In the same way that newspapers, those that do this well, have a charter that ensure that they have an arm's length relationship from their advertisers, their funders. So this idea of editorial independence is central to good journalism, and there's no reason why in this model that we're advocating the same approach, the same sort of safeguards.
This is Cole Moynihan reporting for The Wire.
And that's all for today. Great to have you with us wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between Radio Adelaide, Sydney's 2SER, 4EB in Brisbane, RTRFM in Perth and Karma Radio Alice Springs, and is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can hear us weekdays same time on your local community radio station. Check us out on thewire.org.au to listen back to anything you heard here today, and find us online on Twitter, The Wire Radio, and Facebook, The Wire Independent Current Affairs on Community Radio. Today's program came to you from our studios here in Brisbane. My name is Stephen Regal. Thank you so much for your company, and we will see you next time on The Wire.